Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at freestylelibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today we're talking to Steve Bassey, the CEO and founder of Polyswarm, which is a crowdsourcing malware detection and threat intelligence company. Sounds very exciting. And here to tell us all about it is the CEO and founder, Steve Bassey. Hello, Steve. How are you?
Hey there, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's welcome. It's very good to have you on. You're very welcome. And Kenny, how are you doing?
Yes, I'm all good today, Mark. Thank you very much for asking. And great to have you on, Steve. And
thanks for having me, Kenny.
Yeah, no problem. And I believe you're located somewhere warmer than Scotland at the moment, but it's particularly cold.
I am. I'm staying down in Puerto Rico, in the Caribbean.
Yeah, go on. Make me jealous, Steve. What's the temperature there?
Oh, it's about 78 right now.
Yeah, that sounds like heaven.
Sunny.
I think we're at 10 degrees C at the moment, which is, it's not very good for the middle of May, but that's what happens when you live in Scotland. You know, you get four seasons in one day, but there we go. Anyway, it's great to have you on. And what we like to do in this podcast, Steve, before we come on to talk about Polyswarm and Nectar Token, et cetera, we'd like to find out a bit about you, you know, what you've done in the past, where you were brought up, and ultimately your journey through life and how you ended up at Polyswarm. So really, it's our next maybe 10, 15 minutes is a floor show for you, Steve, to give us a kind of a potted history of Steve Bassey. And it's up to you how far back you want to go. You can go to your childhood, your early education, university, etc. It's really an open forum for you to tell us all about you.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'll try and give you a little background. I grew up in a small farming town in California. And if you've ever read any, you know, John Steinbeck, East of Eden, Mice and Men, any of those books.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So the areas he writes about is basically where I grew up as a kid. So rural farming town, California, but the saving grace is it was about maybe an hour and a half drive from Silicon Valley. In the 90s was when I sort of started getting into computers and computer security, back when the world was a little bit simpler. Tech people, I feel like we always date ourselves by which modem speed you first got access to the internet with, and I'd say what mine was a 14.4 baud or kbaud modem. So it was quite a while ago, and we were lucky enough to have these local internet service providers that were kind of growing at the time. And somehow I managed to convince my parents that I deserved an account there. And then that's how I kind of got started in computing and the internet. And so it was really lucky to find that, especially in a rural town where, you know, agriculture is kind of the norm. And that was the usual career path.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, grew up, and I remember when we first got access to the the web, you know, this is the time of, did you remember Netscape Navigator? Mm-hmm. Did you ever use that browser back in the 90s? And you actually, to get on the internet, you used to have to go down to a software store and buy a shrink-wrapped copy of Netscape's Navigator to install on your machine to access the internet. So it was pretty interesting.
Mm. Yeah, and, you used to get free with magazines and things like that, didn't you? You bought a computer magazine.
Yeah, the good old AOL CDs, you know, your first 100 hours.
Oh, the AOL CDs, I know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I still have an AOL email address.
Oh man, I don't know if I have one anymore. I know I was when I read the recent news that they had shut down AOL Instant Messenger, and like what was that, like 2018? It was relatively recent, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. That was a bit of nostalgia gone a long time ago. I don't know. When did ISP, or when did you guys sort of start gaining access to the internet? When did that start becoming big in the UK?
I think I got online. I tell you when I got online for the first time. It was, and Kenny will laugh. It was when I went to public school for a couple of years, and obviously, you know, it's a private school, so they have, you know, a lot of money. And that was when I first went online, which would have been 1997, I reckon. And then not long after that, my dad, through the school, because they were buying a load of new computers, they were offering parents the ability to get in and get them a bit cheaper because they were doing such a bulk order. And I think in about 98, 99, my dad bought our first PC for the home. I don't even know if it had I can't remember if it had a modem built in. I think it was one of these external ones eventually that we had to plug in. But yeah, 97, I reckon. Kenny, are you gonna beat
them? Yeah, I'm a wee bit before that. I think I'd be about 94, I think, possibly. Maybe just before that. And it was Windows 3.1, I think, was the operating system.
Windows 3.1.
Yeah.
So I recently learned that you know those electric toothbrushes, the Sonicare toothbrushes. Mm. They have the equivalent of a 286 inside of them. So you know that Windows 3.1 machine I used to have is now apparently in an electric toothbrush.
Okay.
That was sort of my early background. You know, once I started getting online, I kind of started, you know, reading a lot online and just a lot about all these utilities at the time. And there was actually a big underground and web scene that was all about, you know, producing tools for phone phreaking. Have you guys ever heard of that before?
No, I haven't heard of that.
That's new one to me.
Yeah, that's... so basically it was this idea that there was all these sort of secrets of the US telecom system, and you could, you know, download or sort of create these devices that would allow you to get free phone calls at payphones and things like that. Okay. So that was reading all about that was kind of my intro to security. And then you find, you know, the online chat channels and stuff like that, learning a lot more. And that was how I got into the whole computer security thing, and was lucky enough to use those skills kind of playing around through my ISP account. But then I happened to gain access to a local company without their consent. They found out, and instead of being referred to the local police, I was they called me up and said, well, why don't you come work for us for summer and add to your skill set and have a useful job out of it. So that was my early years. And I had a set of these IT guys that really, took me under their wing. And by the time I was, you know, in high school, I was touching, you know, $100,000 servers that were, you know, servicing 200-300 users, and, you know, early routers from Cisco and 3Com and stuff like that. And it was so I was really lucky to sort of gain access to that sort of mentorship and technology at an early age. So it was kind of my teenage years.
Yeah, that sounds so. You were still at school when you were doing that summer summer jobs. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah, that was exactly right. And by the time I was, you know, old enough to drive, I had basically, you know, paid for my first car with summer computer based jobs, and that was kind of the start of the whole thing. And you know, made it through. You know, started focusing more on math and computer science in high school, and ended up in the Silicon Valley for college, and as a computer engineer. And you know, that's where I sort of started understanding, you know, how software is built, and how we introduce all these complexities and security issues into all the software as we build it, right? You know, that old, I don't know if it shows up in British English very often, but that adage in American English that goes break fast and move, or you know, move fast and break things. That seems to be the mantra of software developers everywhere, as yeah. it were.
Yep. So you left college. What was your first role after college?
Yeah. So I actually I was lucky enough in the U.S. As you've seen from the, I don't know if you've been following the Colonial Pipeline news this week or any of the other you know, cybersecurity proclamations from our government. But for 10 years now plus, there's been a real lack of you know, well-trained people in cybersecurity that are also, you know, in government service. So mm-hmm. there was this program when I graduated, my undergraduate, that was the U.S. government would actually pay for your advanced master's or PhD in computer science. You could sort of take a salary while you were going through graduate school. And the only part of the bargain was after you got out, you had to take a federal government position, you know, in cybersecurity for 2 years to sort of repay that that education. And so I ended up going straight into grad school on that, and ended up somewhere called the Naval Postgraduate School. If you've ever heard of the Naval, the Annapolis. The U.S. Navy's undergraduate institution, Naval Postgraduate School, is kind of like the graduate school to the U.S. Naval Academy. Mm-hmm. So I ended up there actually working real closely with a bunch of military guys. And something that's kind of interesting how that works in the U.S. is we actually have a lot of officers from different countries, different allied countries that go to the school in California for their postgraduate education. So I was lucky enough to be getting a computer science degree alongside of all these naval and military officers from, you know, places like Singapore, Greece. There was a couple from the UK there. So that was a real interesting graduate experience for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that comes from a naval background as well.
Oh, really?
I kind of know what it's like to work with some of these guys. Some of them are a breed of their own, so they are. I worked in the submarine simulators and one of the bases in Scotland. So, yeah, some interesting characters, definitely, and especially some mariners. They are wired to the moon, so they are. But I take my hat off them. Anyone that can go under the water for 3 months at a time and not surface, yeah, you've got to have a screw loose somewhere, definitely.
Absolutely.
All good fun. They like to have a drink and they know how to party. So,
I expanded my vocabulary quite a bit very quickly, those guys.
Yeah, they've got their own language called Jack Speak. So they have, I don't know if it's the same in the States, but they have a... I'm trying to think about it. You know, it's a bit like Raymond slang. Instead of saying the actual word, they'll call it something else. So the toilet is the heads. You know, they don't use the English word for it. They make up their own name for it, which is fine. Obviously, obviously, board and patrols and things like that, and they come up with all these different names. But no, a good bunch of guys, and I'm sure that taught you a few things, life lessons as well.
Yeah, it was definitely those guys are very, very well educated, very, very smart. So that was an interesting 2 years for sure.
Yeah. So it was like a 2 year payback. That was a deal, yeah, for your graduate.
Yeah, yeah. And then I ended up after that as actually a computer science research scientist for the Navy. And we ended up, without getting too deep into it, working on essentially wireless security, for lack of a better term. So the Wi-Fi cards that are in everybody's, laptops and iPhones and stuff, really, really looking deeply at how those are built and how they communicate with other systems and, what that means for the users of those wireless cards with respect to, their own defensive security. That makes sense. And that was maybe like 2012. So mm-hmm. there's been a lot of strides in the security aspects of Wi-Fi. I don't know if you saw it recently, but there was a bunch of late breaking discoveries that basically all the wireless devices we use right now, there's pretty deep flaws in the protocol. This was a couple of days ago. So everybody's kind of working through the patches for those right now, which should be interesting in the coming weeks to see what happens there.
All right. No, I wasn't aware of that, Steve. I'm sure there'll be updates galore for Windows and all the different operating systems coming down the pipeline. But where could that? I mean, obviously, I see you founded a company. Was that, when did you found this NARF Industries? Was that?
Yeah, I did. That's a good question. So once I left government service, we at the time, as part of this graduate degree, we were playing something called Capture the Flag. And this isn't the traditional version of Capture a Flag where you're, out in the field with a paintball gun or whatever. This is the nerd version of Capture the Flag. So there's all these games that occur, at different hacker conferences around the world. And there's a, the organizers essentially set up a closed network of, custom applications and custom servers and devices. And they give every team a copy of those, of essentially this challenge set. And then they pit, 7, 8, 10, 20 teams against each other. And their job is essentially defend the software that they've been provided, never seen before, and also attack the same software running on other teams' machines and sort of break into those computers and try and steal the flag that's sitting on those computers, for lack of a better term, except the flags are, electronic and digital. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of these, hacking war games for fun type thing. While we were in grad school, we played these games with a team called School of Root, and that team had won the a couple years I was on it. We happened to win the World Series of these Capture the Flag competitions that occurs at DEF CON in Las Vegas every year. So through that, I met a lot of people on the team and other teams who had left government and started their own boutique cybersecurity, research team firms. And so I had a couple ideas with a couple people we'd played Capture the Flag with, kicking around for that. And that was why I left government service, to start that company and sort of, research those ideas further and see if that could work. So we ended up doing having quite a reasonable sized research portfolio for have you ever heard of an agency called DARPA in the US?
No, it's a new one to me, Steve.
Yeah. So if you've ever seen pictures of the how the original internet was developed, there it came out of DARPA, and it's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So they did all the initial research behind the internet back when it was called ARPANET. Only existed at, I think it was like Berkeley and MIT were the sort of the hubs of this thing. And the routers for this were the size of a refrigerator at the time. And so they have this long history of, doing these really blue sky research projects you know, for the military, for the Department of Defense and stuff. But a lot of cool technology comes out of there. So, you know, they did a lot of the initial stuff behind self-driving cars, for example. So they had this thing called the Grand Challenge where, I don't know if you remember this, maybe 10 years back, maybe a little closer, where the challenge was to have a self-driving car make it across this, you know, this obstacle course in the desert without wrecking. Did you guys see this news over in the UK? So it was kind of a popular thing a few years ago.
I don't think we've seen that.
Yes, there was a lot of where the early sort of self-driving car, you know, pioneered technology came from. So they do things like that. Anyway, that's a very long way of saying they did a cyber security edition of the Grand Challenge a few years ago, and my company NARF and a few others we participated in that, and that was interesting. The challenge was all around building artificial intelligence that could identify flaws in software it had never seen before and fix those flaws, you know, and really do a sort of a faster job than a human could, at least in identifying the flaw and maybe creating a patch, right? So imagine if for your Windows updates, you didn't need a developer at Microsoft to sort of find the flaw and patch the flaw. It was just sort of occurring automatically, which is both exciting and terrifying when you think about it.
So obviously now you're with Polyswarm. Steve, so what happened to NARF? Did you sell it on, or did you move on, or you know what happened to the company?
No, NARF's still there.
Still there, yeah.
We actually spun Polyswarm out of NARF in 2018, and
makes sense.
Yeah, that was interesting. So we kept running. Part of what we would do in NARF is we'd show up as what are called incident responders. So you know we'd get a call from a company we knew or someone that we do work before. And, you know, if you saw this Colonial Pipeline shut down this week and that ransomware attack. So that's a good example of where we used to get calls, you know, when I was doing NARF full time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the calls would usually be like, you know, we found some strange activity in one of our networks. It looks pretty, you know, it looks pretty stealthy. You know, can you come in and take a look at a few of the things we found, a few of these, you know, potential pieces of malware? And so we'd come in and take a look at them. And, you know, if you have a piece of malware installed on your machine, usually it depends on the malware, but they have a few common characteristics. Usually they take sort of stealthy control of your machine, and they allow the attacker remote access to the machine to sort of, you know, either steal information or install ransomware. There's a whole host of things that could happen. So we used to go into these engagements, and we'd end up building pieces of software that could sort of detect this malware or communications surrounding this malware in other companies, because it was some of these, you know, threat actors we were finding were definitely look state sponsored. They definitely had an agenda, and they were pretty good at what they were doing, right? So we started building these tools to detect these guys, and we take the tool from, you know, the initial customer to another company that we were pretty sure had these same attackers lurking within their network, and we really couldn't quickly distribute that tool to other companies, and it was essentially like this tool you build that can, you know, detect, you know, hackers inside of a network, but there was no platform that it could sit on and sort of help the next customer or the next person.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the idea behind Polyswarm was, while there's no platform for companies like us, for guys like us that build these detection tools that only really help one customer, they're not distributed well to other companies out there, so they can protect themselves essentially against this malware. So that was the idea behind Polyswarm, and kind of why we spun it out from NARF. But it was definitely incubated with me and my co-founders within NARF.
Yeah. Well, this seems like a good point then, Steve, just maybe to give us a general overview of Polyswarm. I know you've touched on it there, but maybe if you can get into a bit more depth.
Yeah.
What the offerings are. you know, within the company, yeah. you know, who your typical, you know, subscribers are. And then obviously there's a token called Nectar that's part of the ecosystem. So how that all fits in as well. Because when I spoke to Adrian, your chief marketing officer last week, you know, it was quite interesting to hear that, you know, various different sort of software companies compete for your tokens. So I'm interested to hear how that works. So over to you again.
Sure. Yeah, in the security world, there's a lot of marketing hype and a lot of technology buzzwords throwing around, right? And you know, the reality is there's a bunch of different ways to detect malware, right? And you know, at Polystorm, our argument was, you know, we really don't care if an antivirus engine uses, you know, some advanced artificial intelligence to detect malware, or if it just, you know, uses, you know, really good intelligence about a piece of malware that these guys have gleaned through some, you know, trick or some source of information that they have. You know, as long as the software is detecting malware and warning the user about it and making it so the user is protected, you know, it's a win. It's a win for the defenders. So we built this whole competitive framework within Polystorm that's sort of loosely based on something called a prediction market. Have you ever heard of a prediction market before? It's kind of an interesting concept.
No, that's a new one to me as well, Steve. Maybe you can, for the benefit of our listeners, tell us about it.
Yeah, so the colloquial example is always, you know, if you and I, you know, are stockbrokers or, you know, investors, and we wanted to predict the outcome of the next, you know, say presidential election in the US, you know, let's say it's a Biden versus Trump round two, you know, we would put something called a prediction contract out there. And we're asking the market, hey, do you think it's going to be Trump or it's going to be Biden? You know, essentially please stake your opinion with real money on either side. And the contract also has another feature, and it says, you know, the contract automatically closes to new opinions, say a month before the election happens. So let's say we run this process and, you know, a month before the election happens, the contract closes. And you and I, Kenny, are on the, it's going to be, I don't know, Biden again side. And you put down, you know, we'll be currency agnostic here. You put down, you know, five tokens and I put down one token, right? Mm-hmm. And essentially what that expresses is our confidence that it's going to be Joe Biden for president again in 2024. And, you know, is the stockbrokers, you know, who originally initiated the prediction contract, they can basically look at this and go, okay, well, it seems like, you know, Kenny and Steve are, you know, they have six tokens for Biden and maybe there's three tokens for Trump. So that's the market saying roughly 2-1 that they're confident that Biden is going to take it in the election. So the election happens and let's say it's Biden is the winner. They were correct, right? Mm-hmm. So the people on the Biden side, they actually win whatever the stakes were on the Trump side, plus the initial reward that the stockbrokers come in. Or you know, put in, but the really important thing here is before the election happened, we got a really good statistical idea of what might happen in the election, and we got it from all these experts in, you know, maybe polling or maybe demographics or statistics or whatever it was, right? Mm-hmm. The other important feature is they put their money where their mouth is when they said, you know, it's going to be Biden or it's going to be Trump. They put you know, tokens or whatever it was on the line. And that's it's kind of an interesting way about really, you know, really collecting this sort of consensus opinion about an event that's going to happen. So all that I just explained to you, we do something very similar, but we do it for malware, right? So instead of predicting, you know, outcomes of elections or whatever, we predict if something that's been submitted to the Polystorm platform, like a URL or like a file or like an email attachment, is malware or not. And instead of, you know, people predicting if something's malware or not, we actually use this competitive process to let software, specifically antivirus engines, predict whether something is a virus or not, essentially, at the end of the day, with the key difference that there, you know, there's a financial risk and reward to it if they get it right or wrong. And so there's this nice economic pressure that we build into the marketplace to get it right, to detect threats quicker than everybody else.
Yeah. So I'm trying to get my head around this, Steve. So I've got a bunch of files, and essentially I give the files to you, and then it's almost like you put them out to tender to see, you know, which software company is going to get the best results scanning them.
Is that because
I'm looking at all the different engines that you use on the website, and there's loads and loads, and they've all got specific. Is it specialities? You know, some of them are ransomware, some of it phishing. You know, some of it's blockchain's a speciality. So,
yeah, that's exactly right. So the important thing to note is we do this automatically, right? Mm-hmm. And we do this with software. So the transaction sizes aren't high dollar amounts. They're actually sub cents amounts, and that's because currently we're doing anywhere between, you know, 750,000 and a million new pieces of malware per day, or potential pieces of malware that we're running this process on. You know, for each piece of potential malware that comes to the platform, we're getting anywhere between, you know, 10 to 20, assertions on whether or not this thing is malware. So we're really doing this at machine speed in the matter of seconds. And we have, 55 engines on the platform today. We're very proud that, CrowdStrike, SentinelOne, Kaspersky, they're kind of big names, and they've done a lot of innovation in this space, and they're participating in the platform. You'll have to ask them their reasons, but I can opine on why that might be. But the really interesting thing also is, remember when we were talking about NARF? NARF is a small company, and we built these tools that basically did the same thing. But the difference was we were focusing on a very narrow slice of the malware landscape. So maybe we were only detecting malware from one specific team of hackers, right, that were employed by, you know, either a crimeware gang or a state, you know, a government or a quasi-government entity out there. And so the other unique thing about Polyswarm is those types of engines, like we built at NARF, they can compete alongside with the big guys, right? And they really add value because they detect stuff that the big guys may not be focused on yet. And it really adds to sort of this idea that you get this consensus opinion from something like a prediction market. And you do better at protecting users at the end of the day, which is the whole point of this thing.
Yeah, definitely. And so how does the token fit into this then, Steve, the Nectar token?
Yeah, good question. So one of the other things from my time playing Capture the Flag, met a lot of really, really talented, cybersecurity guys around the industry. And they weren't always, English speaking. They weren't always American or Brits or whatever. They were kind of located all over the world. Some really talented teams out of Western and Eastern Europe, out of Japan, where I lived for many years. And so we did this token because we wanted these guys to build engines. We wanted them to build software that would detect new and emergent threats. And we wanted to keep that software up to date. But, you know, these guys, we wanted to, they're already comfortable with cryptocurrencies and with tokens. And so we wanted to make it so, you know, if their engines, you know, detecting thousands of dollars worth of malware every month, we could essentially get that to them quickly and through a blockchain without friction. And so we chose to build this token called Nectar on top of the Ethereum blockchain so we could move these rewards around. In these small amounts quickly. And the other thing we're doing with this is we actually have a white paper that's going to be coming out soon. We're starting to figure out how to pay common users for their cybersecurity relevant, what's called telemetry. So one of the big questions that cybersecurity guys like myself asks, right, is, if we see something that looks like a malicious URL or a new something that looks like new malware, one of the things we're always asking ourselves is, has anybody else seen this in the wild? You know, how common is it? You know, if I had to make an analogy out of it, it's kind of like, you know, the coronavirus variants, right? Everybody's paying a lot of attention right now to, you know, whether there's a South African variant that's becoming more prevalent, or there's a, you know, or some, or the coronavirus is mutating in what's happening in India, and there's new variants that are, you know, not suppressed by the vaccine, those sorts of things. It's almost the exact same thing in malware. You know, these malware analysts, these antivirus companies, they're like, you know, epidemiologists, but not nearly as important as real epidemiologists are lately, apparently. And we have the same questions, right? How many times has this variant of a piece of malware been seen in the wild, right? What, you know, is it communicating with these command and control servers, right? You know, what IPs is it talking with? All these things are called telemetry. And up until now, if you've installed maybe one of the more common antivirus applications out there, users are basically giving that telemetry back to these companies for free. In many cases, they're paying for the antivirus software itself. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
You know, have you heard of this? So it's a lot like the, you know, it's a lot like the online advertising market, right? Where, you know, your data is being used to sort of inform and advance these cybersecurity products. But there's no compensation for the user back for their data that actually helps defend everybody in the end, which is kind of interesting. So we're looking at you. The second reason we wanted to do a token here, and we wanted to make that part of our design, was we wanted to start compensating that people for that telemetry, because it is pretty valuable. And we're just releasing some technical ideas on how to do that now, and I'm pretty excited about how that's going to develop going forward, because I think it'll be really useful.
No, that explains that very well. And I never actually thought of that with all these antivirus companies. People pay an extortionate amount of money for antivirus, and maybe they should be getting money the other way. But just thinking,
possibly.
But just thinking on your business model then. So you're not an antivirus software company. So who are your sort of clients? Where does your revenue come from? The companies pay you to what, firewall for them kind of thing, or what? How does it work?
Yeah. So we've got a few core client types, right? It's interesting. So I'll take you through a few, you know, types of players in the cybersecurity industry, and tell you a little bit about how we work with these guys. And so there's one called Managed Security Solutions Providers, or MSSPs, and they're a lot like your IT service companies, right? Except they're very focused on cybersecurity. So they'll get all the you know, the logs from the firewall logs from a mid-sized business. They'll make sure that they've got an antivirus product installed on their machines. They'll watch their email servers for incoming email attachments and that sort of thing. And what they're looking for there, they take all that information back into a process and a set of, you know, automated systems that they've built. And they have these guys that sit in what's called a security operations center, and they look at all that data, and they essentially look for attacks on their customers' business or networks and computers. And you know, when they find incidents, or when they get alerts that bad things are happening, or they notice something weird in their customers' logs, they help them respond to those threats as sort of an outsourced service, right? So you know, good example. I was talking to one of our customers today, and they're in the MSSP space, and they are helping respond to a ransomware incident right now for one of their customers. And so, how PolySwarm helps them quite directly is, you know, we detect a lot of ransomware, and that's 750,000 to 1 million files a day that are going through the platform. And we detect it a lot sooner sometimes because of our competitive process. So we have a lot of information about how to detect this, what the ransomware behaves like once it gets into an environment. And, you know, when this piece of ransomware is first seen, and in some cases we can tell you, you know, how often variants of the same ransomware family have been seen, right? So it gives these MSSP customers a real way to sort of focus on the threats that are relevant today and make sure that they're actively looking for that sort of malware in their customers' environment so they can be more responsive to the threats that are likely to bring their customers down, just like the Colonial Pipeline stuff you've seen, which has been huge in the news this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's almost like a virtuous circle because you guys are providing feedback to try and detect these threats earlier. So that's definitely an interesting model and obviously a successful model as well. Who are the competitors then out there, Steve?
Yeah, good question. There's a few. VirusTotal is kind of the one we have talked about. So VirusTotal, they were a Spanish company. They were acquired by Google, and I believe it was 2008. And they still run today as part of Google. Those guys are super smart. They did pretty great things for the industry. But part of what they did was they had this model where you could give VirusTotal a file, and they would run it through a bunch of the world's virus scanners and tell you what the scanners thought about it. But they, where we're innovating here is really this competitive model that we built in PolySwarm, and this ability to get these small focused research-driven antivirus engines that only focus on narrow threats. VirusTotal, I think they're doing about 500,000 new samples a day currently. They still have some great data, and they still help protect a lot of people. But they're owned by Google now, and Google has a very specific way that they they want to see that data used. And that's sort of what we see from VirusTotal today. We've actually found that the antivirus companies themselves, have been very supportive of what we're doing because, they're very interested, to their credit, in being better at detecting new threats. So, they're interested in PolySwarm's data, and they're a second big segment of our customer base. They're very interested in our data today, what kind of malware we're seeing, how often we're seeing it, any new samples that look like variants of old stuff they've seen. Because they want to know about this data. They want those epidemiological samples. So if their engine is, detecting them or not detecting them, they can make adjustments to make sure that they're protecting their clients better. I'm very excited about how PolySwarm is able to sort of help in that vein, and we're really seen as a resource by the antivirus industry, and that's been nice so far.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads me sort of nicely on to so what you mentioned, the white paper, a new white paper earlier on. What's the roadmap like, for the rest of 2021 for PolySwarm?
Yeah. So one of the things we realized, our initial white paper, we released it almost 3 years ago now. No, longer than 3 years ago, I think. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Our original white paper was very focused on the competitive detection of malware and people building software and engines to do this. And that's still very much something we're releasing. But I think in 2021, we're going to start to build this concept of collecting and paying for telemetry from common users, as they go about their daily computer usage, browsing the web or whatever. But part of the white paper is doing this in a privacy sensitive way, and also giving giving users, normal users, a benefit for this really valuable cybersecurity related telemetry. And we were really inspired by, have you guys heard of the Brave browser at all?
No.
Nope, not at all.
Yeah. And so it was this concept, they actually took a fork, they actually forked Google's Chrome browser and built into it this essentially set of technologies where, as you're browsing the web, if you're doing it through the Brave browser, every time you see a banner ad or some sort of advertisement that's served to you, you would actually you would earn a few tokens for your attention. to that banner or to that ad, right? And so it was this way of, instead of all this data being collected about users to sell back to the advertisers, it was a way about, you know, giving the users a cut of that revenue and that benefit for providing, you know, valuable data about their spending habits and their interests and stuff that advertisers really wanted to see. So kind of cutting out the middlemen and the telemetry there. We're trying to do a very similar thing in this white paper, right? But we're just trying to do it for, you know, cybersecurity related data and malware, because to their credit, sort of the incumbent technology players, Apple, Microsoft, Google, they have started to make certain streams of data much more private. I can sort of go into those, but as part of that, they're removing data streams like passive DNS is what it's called, that allows cybersecurity defenders to really see if there's a new phishing domain that's popped up and where it's being accessed and where it's popular. And so we want to make sure that those defenders continue to have access to that telemetry, to that data, but that the users at the other end are not, are compensated for that. And they're not feeling like they're, exchanging that data and losing their privacy and receiving nothing in return at the same time. So we're trying to do that in a very privacy-centric way while also still helping the cybersecurity defenders on the other side.
All right. So it sounds these guys are going to be busy for the rest of the year anyway, going forward in 2022.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So getting the initial implementation of that out this year is something I really like to see. And I know my team is excited about it as well.
Yeah. And what kind of size of team have you got at PolySwarm? Just when you mentioned team.
Yeah, we've got about 18 people right now. So we're a relatively small team. We're really looking to add on that to the development side. But the team is, split about half between development and the rest of behind, sales and business development. And the software developers, we have this constant push and pull in our product meetings, because there's so many things that we can take this sort of, decentralized competitive model to in cybersecurity. But we're trying to do the biggest impact ones first, which is why the telemetry is next on our list. And the thing that's exciting about the telemetry and compensating people for that is it's a much wider audience than just, malware experts who can develop software. That's a much more narrower slice of the population, but, people who browse the internet and run across things like phishing sites occasionally and potential malware occasionally, that's a much bigger segment of the population because it's basically everybody that uses a computer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, it's I'm looking forward to hopefully maybe getting you back on at some point and keeping us in the loop what you guys are up to. But I mean, that's believe it or not, that's been about nearly 45 minutes, Mark. Is that right? We've been talking already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, over 45 minutes.
Over 45 minutes. Yeah, time flies, so it does. But fantastic, Steve. It's good to to hear technology, advancing on all fronts and all sorts of things going on in the background that we just take for granted. But appreciate your time today and thanks for coming on, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Mark, have you got anything to finish it off with?
No, I'm all good. I think we pretty much covered everything, I think, there, didn't we? Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very wide spectrum we covered.
It's a very different sort of thing to talk about on our podcast, for sure.
but we like variety, so we do, Steve.
But yeah, we like to see, and then particularly in the crypto space as well, businesses in there, that's I think there'll be more and more that we talk on the podcast, won't there, I think, the way things are going.
Definitely.
Yeah, we survived the crypto winter. I have long tales about, I get into Bitcoin about 2010. So very, very long tales about the initial Bitcoin white paper. And, it's an interesting last decade in cryptocurrency for sure.
Yeah.
And there's as we spoke to somebody yesterday, I mean, it's a bit of a wild west out there at the moment in the crypto space. There's so much going on and so many tokens, and you know, some of the millionaires that have appeared overnight. It's just crazy out there. It really is. Interesting how long it lasts, if it's going to burst or if it just keeps going and going. I don't know. It's a strange old world out there, but you can't stop it. It's got momentum now, so we've just got to accept it's part of our life. And if you've got to embrace it. You've got to get involved with it if you want to stay ahead of the game. So great stuff. All right. Well, thanks for your time today, Steve. We'll let you get back to your 78 degrees in Puerto Rico. And I'm just
guys. Sorry. I'd love to I'll trade you a beer in a pub for a mojito on the beach one of these days.
Definitely.
Yeah, thank you very much, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, of course. Cheers. All right, gentlemen. Good to chat.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.